RadioInfluence.com. This is Landry Football on Radio Influence, the only podcast where you can get perspective of what happened on the gridiron through the eyes of a coach, scout, and front office administrator. Now, it's time to step into the film room. Here's Chris Landry.
Welcome into the Thursday, October 25th edition of the Landry Football Podcast. Folks, the season is going by faster and faster every year. It means I'm getting older and older, I know, but man, what an interesting season it has been thus far. Heading into week 8 in the NFL, heading into week 9 of college football, we want to focus in on all that action for you and with you today, as we've got the largest outdoor cocktail party. Yes, I am still calling it the outdoor cocktail party. Political correctness to be damned. That's what it is known for, and that's what we'll call it. But we've got some other interesting games that we're going to get into, as well as some Big Ten West games. We've got a couple of other SEC games that are intriguing. Get into a lot of it. Some of the issues about the out and about the world of college football. Got some questions to answer as well. Want to remind you that if you've got any questions for me to address here on the show, we'll do so. All you got to do is contact us at Landry Football. Hit contact Chris and let us know, and we will handle it for you right here on this podcast. So we've got a few questions to ask. Looks like, let's see, this one is NFL related. We've got one that's college football. We've got two NFL related, two college football related. So we'll get to those. We've got going to get into the week that will be in the NFL. Big Saints-Vikings game on Sunday night. Got some other good matchups. We'll take a around the landscape of college football as well. So want to start off, though, with the reminding you that, as we do every time here, what we love to do is to invite you to join us at LandryFootball.com, because we have a forum there in which we can really go into greater detail, give you a lot more information about the college teams, the NFL teams, breaking them down inside the film room, giving you all the details from inside the coaches' offices. And we break down, obviously, in the latter part of the week, all these games. So we've got, guys, we've got so many college games to break down. We won't get to all of them here, but you can get to them on LandryFootball.com, and you get them in great detail of what we think about the game, the notes, what the film is saying. So we get into all those details. All you got to do is check us out at LandryFootball.com. Give us a try for a month. You've got a better deal in 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, or even a year. It's a great opportunity. You can get that access that other NFL teams, 32 NFL teams, we're heading towards 80 college football programs now that are members, and it's very inexpensive for you. It's less than a magazine subscription, and you can get those breakdowns on recruiting. We are heavily involved in getting more and more of that information on there for you. As we mentioned, college football, the draft, NFL, coaching search matters, which are getting bigger and bigger and busier as we approach that time of year. So we're going to talk a little bit about everything to do with the college game, the pro game. Remind you that we also can catch us on the Rush the Field podcast every Wednesday, where we with Scott Seidenberg, where we break down the college game. All right, let's get into a couple of things, starting with the college scene. We've got an intriguing night of Thursday night, Friday night college football, and we're getting into the point of the year where we're going to start to see games. If you got a chance to watch on Tuesday night, Troy in South Alabama, we're going to get closely into, in a couple of weeks, where in November, where we're going to start to have games on Wednesday night in addition to Tuesday night. So, folks, if you're a football junkie, and we know you are, you're going to have a football game every night. I can't remember the exact starting date. I'll get that for you. But where you're going to have football every night all the way through the end of the season, through end of December, because what's going to happen is you're going to have, we know you've got your traditional Thursday, Friday night college games. You got your NFL game on Thursday night. Of course, you got Saturday and Sunday, we know. And then Monday night's Monday night football. Then when you add the Tuesday and Wednesday night, and it'll be the MAC games, Sunbelt games, but those are really good, fun games where you can see good teams. So remind you that if you're interested in watching some college high school football on Friday night, you're going to see two of Alabama's commitments at quarterback, including Tua Tagliova's brother. It's going to be playing Paul Bryant's great grandson be playing in a game, so you'll get a chance to watch some college football as well. I believe ESPN2 carries that. So a lot of football coming up, but Thursday night we've got Baylor West Virginia, and then we also have Georgia Tech Virginia Tech. You also got Ball State Ohio. You got Toledo Western Michigan in the MAC, of course, and then you've got Appalachian State Georgia Southern. So some really good matchups when you got five games on Thursday. So it's a really big night. Friday night you've got Louisiana Tech Florida Atlantic. See Lane Kiffin. You got Miami Boston College Indiana Minnesota, which is really big for PJ Fleck, needs a win there. Wyoming, Colorado State, and Utah, UCLA. So you got a little bit of a five-card Monty masterpiece on Thursday night and Friday night for the college football fans. And, oh, by the way, remind you that you have the traditional Thursday night NFL game, the Dolphins at the Texans. So a lot of football that should cure your itch. Get the football weekend started off nice. Want to talk a little bit about Baylor West Virginia. Watch this West Virginia team. I mentioned a few weeks ago I was a little bit concerned coming out of that Kansas game when they really started to play, dare I say, in a very sluggish fashion. And it's led to some issues. I'm curious to see if they can get back on track. Now, Matt Rhule's done a really nice job with this program. We know about all the off-the-field issues. Nice little test for West Virginia to see if they can get back on track in this game. For Georgia Tech, Virginia Tech in Blacksburg, it is getting a little bit uncomfortable with Paul Johnson at Georgia Tech. They're getting a little bit uneasy there, getting more and more conversations about, Chris, what could we do here? Where could we go? We think the time has run out. I don't know with what's left on his deal that they're willing to make a move this year. I do think, though, when you are having those type of concerns, question marks, it's pretty important that you finish up. Well, they're 3-4. They're 1-3 in the league, 3-4 overall. I think it's really important that they manage to finish the season on an uptick and make a bowl game. If they don't, they'll have a decision to make. I think if they do go to a bowl game, then I think things will be fine. But they got North Carolina, which is really struggling, Miami, Virginia that's playing well in Georgia. So, you know, you're dealing with, at this point, the unlikelihood that you're going to make a bowl game. Okay, you lose to Virginia Tech, you beat North Carolina, can you beat Miami or Virginia? Can you get two more wins out of it? Can you get to six wins? Can you get to five? I mean, if you end up as a three-win team, I think that kind of sounds the alarms that the program is maybe spiraling out of control. You know, people think oftentimes when you're not involved with the program that, what's the difference with three wins and five wins? You know, you're not going to a bowl game. It's a bad season. But there's a huge difference, and this is where some of these games are important for the direction of your program and to get the spike in needed into kind of regenerating things in a positive way from a recruiting standpoint. So I think it's an important game for Paul, but it's at the same token, it's important for Justin Fuente at Virginia Tech. Now, he's in no danger. He's early on or anything. But I think right now they're not really pleased with what Justin has done to this point, in that I think they've underachieved a little bit. Now, they are obviously going to be starting another quarterback, and we'll see how that plays out. This would be a tough loss for Virginia Tech. Miami-Boston College, really good game on Friday night. What is Mark Richt doing with the quarterbacks? The inconsistent play that's always plagued him. You've got Boston College at home. That the healthy A.J. Dillon, really good team. Going to be a real interesting matchup there. Then you got Indiana-Minnesota, and this I will get into a question that I'll tie into this. Tom Allen's done a pretty good job with this Indiana team. They've competed, but the record's not all that good. Minnesota, you know, P.J. Fleck, for all the talk and all the bravado and the sizzle, there's just not been a lot of substance since he's been there at Minnesota. It is not expected that they win or win big. But, you know, they haven't won a Big Ten game. And this is a game at home that if you're going to have a program that you're going to continue to try to sell and it not be a hollow sell, you got to win this game at home if you're P.J. Fleck. And it asks, I'm going to go right into the question about P.J. Fleck. P.J. Fleck, how far can he take this Minnesota program? Well, you know, if you look at Minnesota's history, and I'm talking about modern-day history, because Minnesota's longtime history, you go back at Minnesota, they won national championships at University of Minnesota, but that was before integration. In modern-day times, you've had, you know, Lou Holtz did a pretty good job at Minnesota. Clint Mason did a pretty good job at Minnesota. You know, you've had some guys do a decent job and pull a win here or there. P.J. Fleck hasn't done anything since he's been there other than try to sell the program and the row the boat and all the sizzle. There's just not a lot of substance there. You wonder where the talent level is going to come in from, that I thought he would be able to get some better-looking players into the program. He has not gotten enough of them at this point. And certainly the on-field product hasn't been very good. You sit there by comparison and say, well, give him time. Yeah, absolutely. He deserves all the time and they should give him time. But do I look at P.J. Fleck and say, yeah, he can do what Jeff Brohm is doing at at Purdue? Jeff Brohm went to Louisville, Freudian slip there. And no, I don't. I don't see any of that. And let me just say this. Purdue is one of the tougher places to recruit because I don't think people are aware that Purdue has some of the academic requirements and restrictions that doesn't get the publicity. That is kind of like – that is closer to Northwestern in terms of what their recruiting pedigree is than people might know. And, you know, we know Northwestern has been solid and win and is consistent. Now, you know, Pat Fitzgerald's been there a long time. Jeff Brohm hasn't. Jeff has been able to find a niche offensively. He's very creative. He's recruited some big-time talent that has come in. Not a lot, but some that have kind of changed the direction. And we know, look what they did last year. That's not happening at Minnesota. So the answer to your question is, I think Minnesota is capable, very capable, of being a successful program. Successful meaning certainly as good as the academic schools like Northwestern and Purdue. Absolutely capable in terms of what the resources and facilities are. It is not great, but it is absolutely comparable with those schools. Now, that's where they should be. They're not there now. So the answer to your question of where should they be, well, they should be that. I don't expect them, if I'm looking at them, if I see programs, if I'm going to rank and say that certainly Ohio State and Michigan in the East and Penn State in the East are really the upper tier resources in the East, Michigan State would be the next, and that's how that conference usually shakes out. If you're looking at resource-wise, then you're dealing with Maryland, then you're dealing with Indiana, then you're dealing with Rutgers. it kind of falls under those lines in terms of the wins and losses. If you're looking at the West, now Northwestern has finally gotten facilities that are big time, but they've operated in substandard facilities. If you'll get Northwestern and Nebraska, their facilities are really good. They are, Nebraska's been as good for as long a while. Wisconsin and Iowa's are solid facilities, good facilities. So are Minnesota's. They're all better than Purdue's. Illinois is a little bit behind in facilities. You know, so where does that really take us in this? Minnesota should be potentially the high water mark for Minnesota is to be what Iowa is, to be what Wisconsin is, to be what Nebraska wants to be, certainly to be where Purdue is right now. And I think the biggest drawback or the biggest downfall to what PJ has not done at Minnesota is to look at what's happening at Purdue and how quickly Jeff Brohm has done that. Don't look at Kurt Ferentz at Iowa, who's been there forever. Don't look at Mark D'Antonio, who's been there for a while, and Michigan State's had more success in history, sustained history. Don't look at Wisconsin, who's been successful under two or three coaches and a really good program. Don't look at Nebraska, who's, quite frankly, has been really down, but we know their history and tradition. But look at Purdue. Don't look at Northwestern, because Pat Fitzgerald's been there a while. But look at Purdue. Facilities are not any better than Minnesota's. I've been to many both times, and they're both solid. I think that probably Minnesota's is a little better. Purdue's not had a run of good coaching hires since Joe Tiller, so their program has been down. I think Purdue and Minnesota is a fair comparison, particularly since Purdue's a tougher job. Purdue's got tougher academic restrictions than does the University of Minnesota. And there's no question that Jeff Brohm has done a great job. So to compare someone to Jeff might be a little unfair, but how unfair is it? PJ Fleck, if you listen to him, he's the next greatest thing, and he's going to just talk you into oblivion and row the boat and feeling elite. There's nothing elite looking about the Minnesota program. It should be showing improvement. Not good, but showing improvement. If they go through and don't win a couple of Big Ten games this year, I mean, they've got Illinois, they've got Indiana, they should win a couple of games. You know, and by next year, they should be competing in bowl games. If they don't do that, then they're definitely are falling short, in my view. Utah, UCLA, quietly, this Utah team is playing really good ball. If they can get, and this is part of what well-coached teams do, they get better as the year goes along. UCLA's playing better. Utah's getting a little done offensively, really good defense, really good on special teams. Should be a fun game to watch as well on Friday night. On Saturday, in the early window, yeah, Clemson, Florida State, that's supposed to be the big game. It's not. It's Clemson, and how interested are they in the game? It's as simple as that. Purdue, Michigan State, very underrated game. Because what does Purdue do coming off the big win going on the road in East Lansing? Wisconsin, Northwestern. Wisconsin, can they take care of business? I think the West is ripe if Wisconsin doesn't take care of business. We thought Wisconsin would kind of take care of it. This is going to be quite the battle. I think Northwestern can take advantage of mistakes. And if Wisconsin's going to throw the football in harm's way, they can absolutely beat Wisconsin here at home. In that early window as well, we got North Carolina, Virginia. Expect Virginia to continue to play well. Nebraska will get their win against Bethune-Cookman. Want to see Texas Tech going to Iowa State. Very underrated Big 12 game on Saturday. On the second wave of games, that's where we've got the big Florida-Georgia matchup. We've got all these matchups broken down inside the film room. But the real synopsis of Florida-Georgia is, what has Georgia done in the bye week to improve and get better? Because we know that last outing was ugly. Florida's playing with house money. Florida's playing aggressive, well-coached. Going to be a fun one to watch. At the same window in the SEC, Kentucky-Missouri. Watch out, Kentucky. Don't get behind this Missouri team. Don't play from behind. You're going to have some problems. That's not your game. This is a keep it in the phone booth, grind it out, wear down Missouri's front type of game for Kentucky. Missouri wants to speed it up, get some points, force Kentucky to play from behind. Going to be a real interesting matchup because this sets up for Kentucky. If Kentucky wins and Georgia wins, what a hellacious matchup to lead into the LSU-Bama game in the SEC would be Georgia going to Kentucky. But we could see one team win, one team lose, or both win. Iowa goes to Penn State. This Iowa team's playing better than any team in the Big Ten West right now. But this Penn State team is dangerous because they've got really good team speed. They're at home. Going to be interesting to watch there. USC, this is a Clay Helton may not be able to save his job, but if he doesn't win out and get to the conference championship game, then he's definitely, his goose will be cooked. So winning at home against Arizona State is a must. Illinois, Maryland won't be much of a game. TCU, Kansas shouldn't be much of a game for the Frogs. Duke at Pitt, Duke should be able to handle them. Oklahoma should be able to handle Kansas State with ease. The Kansas State situation is going to be interesting to watch because I don't know. Listen, we're at the point where we're on a year-to-year basis with Bill Snyder. I know he signed a new deal. I think he's going to stay, but, you know, with the health, you never know how that'll play out. That's getting really interesting, but they normally are good to put a scare into a team like Oklahoma. They just don't have the ability to possess the football to play keep away like they have done in the past. Washington goes to California. Expect it to be closer than you think, but we'll take care of business. NC State, Syracuse. We'll see what NC State can do coming off the throbbing they took by Clemson. Syracuse, always fun to watch. Hey, did you see the young quarterback come in and finish the game for Syracuse? Very curious to see this game. The interesting matchup in this window, a couple of them, Texas A&M, Mississippi State. Want to see the Aggies and see their continued improvement and to see if Mississippi State can get off the mat here. This is a big game in the West. Neither one of these teams are going to win the West of the SEC, but A&M has looked the better team, no doubt. Both sides of the ball. A&M's 3-1 in the league, 5-2 overall. It's Mississippi State, much expected of the Bulldogs, 1-3 in the SEC, 4-3. And this is a game that's going to really bother a lot of people in Starkville if they lose it at home to A&M. And I think A&M's the better team going into the game. Mississippi State can't throw the football well enough, so I expect Thompson to play and see if they can't spark the passing game. But here's the optics of it. You got Jimbo Fisher going into A&M year one. Things weren't awful at A&M. There's some talent there, but there wasn't much direction. But at Mississippi State, there was a well-established program that Joe Moorhead was taking. Now, people overrated them when they thought they could win the West at Mississippi State this year, but it wasn't overrating them to say they could be good and competitive. The fact that they just couldn't move the football all on LSU, if they were to lose this game at home, go 1-4 in the SEC, lose to A&M at home, it'll be, from a quality of life standpoint, not real comfortable for Joe Moorhead. And I think the people that are already doubting whether he's the right fit for the job, this will only perpetuate that feeling. Now, nothing's going to happen. They're not going to move on him after 1 year. State is not the type of program that can do that. But it is something that going forward is going to be a challenge. Washington State, off the big win last week, goes to Stanford. It's not the same type of Stanford team. And Washington State usually does a good job against the physical teams like Stanford. We'll see how that plays out on the forum. Tennessee, South Carolina. South Carolina needs one at home. And Tennessee needs to find a way if they're going to get to 6 wins and go to a bowl game, see if they can pull one out here. South Carolina certainly should win this game at home. Would be an ugly loss for Will Muschamp to lose to Tennessee. Navy, Notre Dame. This is not the game that it has been in the past at times. This is not a vintage Ken Niumatalolo type team. This Notre Dame team will win handily, I would suspect, unless they get bored. Texas goes to Oklahoma State. Dangerous game for Texas in that you don't want to have a letdown. You've got some injuries at quarterback. You wonder the state and the preparation in games that don't necessarily seem as big. This is a big game on a big stage. Oklahoma State's not the type of team that's capable, this version of this team, to consistently win, but they're capable of putting together a good performance at home. Will it be good enough? And then Oregon goes to Arizona late night in the Pac-12 after dark look to it. So keep an eye out on a couple of things. Florida, Georgia, I think the winner likely wins the East of the SEC. Keep an eye out what goes on in the Big Ten West. Wisconsin, can Wisconsin take care of business on the road? Can Purdue take care of business on the road? What about Iowa going to Penn State? That's the toughest matchup. This will start to shape the Big Ten West because you've got Wisconsin and Northwestern and Iowa and Purdue all in the mix. Washington State, can they take care of business and keep things in control for them in the North? Would be big for them to get a rematch against USC in the Pac-12 title game. As I mentioned, A&M, Mississippi State, big for the SEC West, for not for necessarily standings, but for the status of Mississippi State and Joe Moorhead and kind of the old attitude into the program. And then, you know, the overall look of can the top teams can take care of business and control things. LSU, Alabama are off this week. So we shall see how this plays out. We'll have the first rankings on Tuesday. So we'll discuss a little bit likely how it might play out on the Tuesday show next week. And then we'll talk a little bit about a lot about it on Thursday when we get back. Reminder that we'll be breaking down right after the Tuesday ranking announcement. Scott Seidenberg and I will be cutting the Rush the Field podcast that will be available first thing Wednesday morning so that you'll be able to hear our reaction to the rankings. All right, some questions I want to get to. Something about here, Louisville's in Bob Petrino and his situation, and would Jeff Brohm go there? Why would he go there? Isn't it a lateral move? Well, first of all, Petrino has a large buyout. Louisville's had a tumultuous offseason in the athletic department. I can't tell you what they're willing or not willing to do in terms of paying the $17 million buyout off. Do I like the future of Louisville football with Bob Petrino in it? I do not. I don't think he's a very good recruiter, and I think he's kind of lost his way without his cronies in there with him. And I think that because he's not a good recruiter, it's really hard to compete. And he's a good play caller, but he's got to get the right type of quarterback that can kind of lead his offense. Again, he's one of those guys that knows what he knows, but he doesn't do a very good job of filling in all the spaces that you need to be a good program. And that's his shortcoming, and it always has been. And it really is exposed at a place like Louisville that's not a football factory, but very capable of being a good program, I think. Jeff Brohm, would he leave Purdue to go to Louisville? Is Louisville a better job than Purdue? No, it's not. However, for Jeff Brohm, it might be because it's his alma mater. He played there. Always remember this, folks. What you think is a better job doesn't really matter. It's what the candidates think is the better job. And what they think is a better job is dependent upon how they view it. What do they want? What do they like? What are their beliefs? You know, I don't know. I can't answer the question if he would take that job. I mean, I think he'd have an interest in coaching his alma mater, yes. Now, from Jeff's standpoint, as much as he likes his alma mater, I think Jeff can get a better job than Louisville. And I think that's around the corner. So does he hold out for that better job, or does he go to his alma mater and that's where he wants to be? That's a personal question I can't answer. But no, it's not a better job, but it could be a better job for him. His question, Chris, I know you helped get Nick Saban to LSU and maintain a close relationship. Could you explain the circumstances of him leaving LSU, and did he ever consider coming back? yes, I did recommend Nick for the job at LSU when they hired Jerry DiNardo. And then again, after they fired Jerry DiNardo, we were able to have more success. And at that point, I had to work on Nick more than LSU because LSU had an interest, but Nick didn't have as much interest at that point. He was at Michigan State, and he was interested in moving from Michigan State because the president at Michigan State had gone back on some promises he had made, at least in Nick's eyes, of what his expectations were in terms of facilities and support of the program. But he was looking for the right type of job, and he wasn't quite convinced that LSU was, because the first go around, or where they didn't show much interest, and they continued to fire coach after coach. And he, quite frankly, wasn't as convinced this was as good a job as people like myself thought. Well, we went to work on him, and I think a lot Bill Orangebarger, who, you know, I was around the LSU program long before Bill Orangebarger got there, but Bill Orangebarger was somebody that I worked for, and somebody that Bill, that Nick Saban, who did not know, they did not know one another, but Saban respected. And I really believe that the phone call that Orangebarger made to convince Nick that the LSU job was a great job and Bill said as much, that had a lot to do with Nick deciding to want to come. What we talked about with Nick was the proclivity of talent in Louisiana that has gone into the NFL, and that the key was to be able to keep it in state. And one of the issues that he always had at Michigan State, he was always second fiddle to Michigan. And I told him, you go to LSU, there is no, you go to Alabama, there's still Auburn. You go to Georgia, there's Georgia Tech. You go to South Carolina, there's Clemson, and Clemson, there's South Carolina. Florida, you know the drill. You go to Texas, you know. You go to Louisiana, there is one state school. I mean, everybody is not even little brother. I mean, they're stepchildren to LSU. So you had that going for you. So, yes, we were able to get him there. But the big reason why he was able to turn it around at LSU was because he had the support of Mark Emmert, now president of the NCAA. Mark got the facilities built that Nick wanted, put the infrastructure in place, and Nick delivered with building a program that became, for the first time in his history, a consistent championship-level program. So he built that. It was always thought that Nick was going to leave and get an opportunity to go into the NFL, and he'd want to try that as a head coach. So that was always there. There were people that flirted with him, but he wanted the right opportunity. Timing's everything. First of all, the opportunity. Wayne Huizenga, then the owner of the Dolphins, gave him everything. Nick had complete control of the operations, football operations, personnel department. He could hire his GM underneath him. You know, he could, we had a, because I was doing some consulting work for him then. He was putting together a staff to where he had two position coaches. He had like a D-line coach and assistant D-line coach, a linebacker coach, assistant linebacker, quarterback coach, assistant. I mean, he had all of that. So he had everything in place because his idea was he was going to build a program like he's done at Alabama in the NFL to where, you know, a guy would leave, he'd have the replacement already there on staff, and he'd just hire the replacement of the guy that moved up, to the guy that moved up. So you had everything great there. So that offer was there, and it was great. Anything less than that, I don't think he would have left just yet. However, let me tell you something that probably most people don't know. When Mark Emmert left LSU to go back home to Washington to become president of the University of Washington, things were never the same for Nick. He was not as happy. Nick had a hotline directly to Mark Emmert. He needed something, he called Mark. It never was Joe Dean or Skip Bertman, and he didn't fool with those guys. He fooled directly with Mark, and Mark sent the directive down to the athletic director of what he needed to do. And so once Mark left, that wasn't there then. You didn't have the type of president that was connected with Nick. And Joe Dean was kind of on the latter stages of his career as athletic director. Skip Bertman gets hired as the athletic director. Skip Bertman and Nick Saban, Skip didn't like Nick. He liked him as a coach, but, you know, Skip had an ego and thought being a successful baseball coach really, you know, meant that he was it. And, you know, not realizing that, you know, the football coach is really important. And with Nick having a lot of say-so and having full control, you know, that rubbed Skippy the wrong way there and got him, you know, agitated. And it wasn't one of those cases where certainly he tried to hire him, tried to keep him. But, you know, in the end, there were a lot of people that at LSU that administratively that didn't like Nick because he rubbed them the wrong way. He was tough on them. And eventually, you know, Nick was going to leave because he wasn't getting what he needed once Emmert left. So the reality is he was going to leave for the NFL. But the timing was such that, you know, he didn't leave immediately after Emmert left, but he left pretty soon after it and when the Miami job came open. So the answer to the question, and I know people, you know, Terry Saban said, oh, you know, we should have never left Baton Rouge and all that kind of stuff. That's they love the friends and made friends there. But the reality is Nick was never, ever considering in any way, shape, or form coming back to LSU because Mark Emmert was no longer there. And without Mark Emmert, that job wasn't as good in his eyes. LSU doesn't have Alabama's money. Alabama gives everything to Nick that he absolutely needs. When he got the job at Alabama, Nick had his confidant in Mal Moore, and you know Bill Battle and he weren't as close. Greg Byrne understands his role as the athletic director. Here's the bottom line: is Nick has been so successful at Alabama that no one he's gone past the point of needing a confidant as the president or the chancellor. He is the guy, and no one's going to buck him because he's so successful. So he's got everything he needs, and what he decides he wants to wake up tomorrow and get, he gets. So that was never an issue, never anything he was going to leave, and that's why the whole Texas flirtation, that was never going to happen because Nick would never deal with anybody getting into his business. Like Paul Bryant Jr., Bear Bryant's son, who's a very rich man and a very powerful person in the state of Alabama and the most powerful person at the University of Alabama on the Board of Regents, you know, tight with the governors and whatnot of the past and currently. He and Nick kind of butted heads immediately, and then he started to win. Mal Moore was the buffer and said, you know, stay out of his way. And Nick started to win, and then you don't hear a peep from Paul Bryant Jr. now because even though he's Bear Bryant's son, Nick Saban is the king now, and you're not going to irritate the king because he'll be off with your head type of an attitude. So that's kind of the landscape of how it played out, and no, there was never any considerations. Want to talk a little bit, got a question about the Ohio State Buckeye staff. And what are there any issues going on in the Ohio State coaching staff? Let me say this, that there's a lot of high-profile guys with names and experience on that Ohio State staff. Obviously, when you lose, there's it brings a lot of that to light. I can tell you that during the suspension time with Urban, they worked well, but obviously, as Eagles would have it, there's a certain way you have to adjust when you don't have your head coach there. They did a nice job in Urban's absence, and I think Urban was kind of maybe coming into it a little bit, not wanting to mess things up because things were going pretty good. And I think maybe now he's gotten to the point where he needs to get his hands a little bit dirty in things, but some of the problems are on the defensive side. And I think that they have struggled there. So I think he's going to have to step over into that mess and try to fix that. And that's created some tension and some problems. So, you know, now, you know, with Urban, you have the off-the-field issues, but that stuff is – that's over now. I mean, it's not over, but it's over as it relates to – you got to coach this football team this year, and I think that's – he's now, they're in a mold of they have no margin for error. They have to run the table again. And I think stepping in is caused some issues. And that's the best way I can put it. And I think that they've got some problems that they need to figure out. Chad asks, let's see here, is this Chad? Yes, asks about the role of college football analysts that are becoming more popular than ever. What are their responsibilities, offense and defense? Their responsibilities can be varied, but you'll have like an offensive analyst that will study and work on the offensive stuff, meaning they will study opponents' defenses and they will study your team's offenses in ways to improve and work with the coaches to improve those areas. They cannot coach them on the practice field. They can be there at games. They can talk with players. They can do a lot behind the scenes. They just can't go out on the practice field and coach. That's where the limitation is. So you asked the questions about, I thought they couldn't talk to players. Yes, of course they can talk to players. They can talk to players in meetings and at games and whatnot. They're in the press box. They're on the sidelines, whatever their game day responsibilities are. And the game day's responsibilities for them would be the offensive guy would be studying the defensive personnel of the opposition and communicating certain things to, if it's personnel groupings, you will have one coach, like the receiver coach will be in charge in personnel and running back coach may be the signal caller. So there's ways that is organized communication of disseminating the information. The defensive guy does the same thing for the opposing offense. People might ask, studying upcoming opponents. That's the other thing that they do is they will study upcoming opponents' defenses if you're an offensive analyst. And if you're a defensive analyst, you study the opposing opponents' offenses. So you do that, and they all are defined different assignments. And you have other analysts that, like quality control, graduate assistants that break down film. It's much more organized and much more detailed because you have a lot more people. When I was a young coach, I did our advanced scouting. I did our game planning for both the offense and defense. I did the scouting both sides of the field. I did all our quality control work. I did our recruiting. I mean, it was you didn't have the staffs like you do today. You asked, how did the number of analysts help contribute to the football program? Well, just as I mentioned, Chad, it's what it does in modern-day football. Let's go back to the old days where you had, let's call it the Bear Bryant days, in the areas where you had 16-millimeter film. They'd come in, they'd meet a couple hours. Initially, they wouldn't even film practices. They'd look at a little tape. They'd spend most of their time recruiting because they can recruit all year long. They'd go out to the practice field. They'd run basically what they wanted to run. It was not heavy game planning. They didn't have access to a lot of other teams' films, so they did what they did, and that was that. Well, today it's a completely different game. It's a digital age. Everybody's got the film. Everybody films the practice. All the film is in a press of a button is digitized to where you can get all the third and shorts and all the second long and every situation known to man. And now you got more people to analyze it. Well, the money's greater. You have a lot more people in which to be able to do different things so that you segment and organize what everybody does. And so, like anything else, as you examine the information and run it up the totem pole, you get a lot more information and data for the people that are ultimately going to decide on your game plan what you're going to do. People that are going to ultimately decide about, players that are worth looking at from a recruiting standpoint. It just siphons and it gives you a better economized use of time to be able to figure that out. It's a huge help. There's no question about it. Also ask about LSU bringing in Jerry Sullivan to assist with the passing game of LSU. Well, I know you asked him about evaluate him as a coach and as a passing game coordinator. Jerry coached with me at LSU in this first stint. Jerry's a great teacher. He's up in age, doesn't do much in terms of recruiting. He's a good teacher. you know, the development of the receivers, I think, can be questioned. I think there's some big picture issues there. You know, not being there at practice every day doing my consulting work around the country and everything, I can't tell you exactly the development of the receivers. I think that they have – what I've seen is that they've improved to some degree in terms of route running. Has it been an appreciable improvement? I can't say that it has been, but I'm not there at practice every day. There are a lot of things you can do in terms of practice. You ask about what can be done in practice to ensure catching throughout all receivers. Work on the jugs machine. Look, if you got natural hands, you got natural hands. But if you don't have natural hands, you've got to do the best you can to improve your eye-hand coordination. Two things about catching the football. You got to see the football into your hands. So the first thing I always do is I want to study, and this should be done long before now, before practice, but it's important to bring out. You got to get guys vision test. I'm not saying just the typical eye chart. I'm talking there's visual acuity tests you can get. The ability to be able to, the rapid eye movement, the ability to be able to see the football is critical. Just like seeing a football from a pitcher in baseball is critical to being a good hitter. So you want to make sure that's taken care of. If you don't have natural hands, you've got to work on the jugging machine more and more. You got to catch football after football after football. One way to kind of improve your visual acuity is to, and I always did this drill with receivers, is you take them into like a corner of a room with a wall, and you have multiple people throw tennis balls off the wall and make them catch it. It's actually what they teach hockey goalies to do, to be able to quickly notice the puck and do that. Is a really good drill because it makes your eyes really quickly notice the tennis ball and catch it, drop it, catch it. That's a good drill. But then catching balls in the jugs, and what you want to be able to do is cushion the ball into your body. One of the biggest problems with drops is that guys let the ball into their body. You've got to be able to extend your hands and catch the football like a net, bringing it into your body at that point. That is a critical element to catching. So that's something that you can do in improving receivers in practice. Richard asks, what's your assessment of Lovie Smith as a coach? Well, at Illinois, not a great fit, not a great job recruiting. The team's actually not pretty well prepared. The team's actually done a decent job. They're just not talented, and he's not a good recruiter. And they really need a young, aggressive go-getter there. I know that's more Illinois talk than you wanted, but I think Lovie's is proven to be successful. Probably got a raw deal in Tampa, but you know, the situation is that Lovie has really done a nice job. Is he the best at adjusting? Not as great, but he's had a really good career. What are your thoughts on Mike McCoy getting fired for the second year row midseason? Well, it's tough. It's a tough business. If you don't win, you don't have talent, there you go. And you're a bad coach and you get fired. He's had success before as a coach. It's tough. I think Mike's a good coach, but certainly he's had a rough go the past couple of years. And it's a talent issue there. They don't have talent in Arizona with the Cardinals. And, you know, it's not that Mike McCoy's an idiot. They don't have much talent. Has he done the best job of working around it? No, he hasn't. They need a spark. That's what you do. You mentioned you recruited Odell Beckham's dad. What was his dad like as a player? Odell's dad, Odell Beckham Sr., is from Marshall, Texas. He was a running back. He's a tough guy, a little ornery, not overly talented, but pretty good player. Played pretty hard for us. Pretty much what he was. What were your thoughts on the Bears' defensive play calling in Pats versus Bears? I thought they tried to mix things up pretty well and got themselves tricked out a little bit. That can happen. Tom Brady does a really good job of kind of reading your mail pre-snap. And that's what got him. I thought their play calling wasn't a big issue. I think that being able to disguise it, and how they played what they called was the bigger issue. In Cleveland, or a question about Cleveland, is Todd Haley doing an adequate job of scheming to Baker Mayfield's strength? No, I think they've struggled a little bit, but I also think there's some personnel issues around Baker. But it's also a little bit of Baker Mayfield. Baker's got to become a little bit more adept at seeing it, reading it, reacting to it, and making good decisions. He hasn't been all that successful with it. Along with that, this week, going to be interesting in the NFL to see the Saints and Vikings go up on Sunday night. You've got the Vikings defense that is playing better. Secondary, you can still throw on them, but the pass rush is tough. Going to be a challenge. Andres Pete should be back for the Saints. On the road, much like last week against Baltimore, this is a tough test for the Saints. You go on the road against a good defense in Baltimore. Now you go to Minnesota, different environment. We know what happened last year in the playoffs. The motivation thing, all that. Yeah, that's fine. That's good. But really what it's about is how well offensively can they be balanced, be able to get the ball out quickly against the pass rush, much like they did against the Ravens. It's what they did well. And then on the other side, what can they do defensively to match up against a Vikings offense that's got some weapons and Cousins is playing well and got multiple receivers, and how can the Saints match up? Going to be interesting. Biggest game of the weekend, no doubt about it. Philly goes to Jacksonville. Actually, Miami, Houston, let me touch on them. Dolphins and Osweiler, will see if they can get things done on the road. Houston, impressed with their win over Jacksonville. I know Jacksonville's in the tank, but Houston suddenly got back in the division race, and division is looking pretty weak, but they're right in it. Miami can't afford to lose this game, even on the road, to fall further behind in the race in the East that we know that eventually is going to New England. Philly's got to get back on the road against Jacksonville, get back on track. Jacksonville has to get back on track, both in London. Big game for the direction of both of these teams. They're really, really hurting both of them. The Jets go to Chicago. Sam Darnold struggled last week against Minnesota. Bears need this one at home. Tampa, Cincinnati, Seattle, Detroit. Detroit's starting to play well. I like Snacks Harrison addition to that defense. Don't know that it'll do much this week. Seattle starting to play better, trying to make a wild card run. Denver goes to Kansas City. Can Denver slow down Kansas City in Kansas City? I don't think so. I think that's going to be really tough for them. Washington going to the Giants. See if the Redskins can continue to take care of business. Giants are in a bad way. Cleveland on Pittsburgh. Can Cleveland do anything on the road against Pittsburgh? Pittsburgh can't afford to lose this game. Carolina hosting Baltimore. Another tough physical matchup. Good defenses. That's going to be one that's going to look like an old Southeastern Conference game. Indiana, Oakland. Indianapolis, the Colts against Oakland. Can the Raiders get one done? Oh, this may be one of the few games the Raiders can win. Need to get this one in the Oakland Coliseum. The Rams host Green Bay. Can Aaron Rodgers pull it out, give them some trouble, maybe outscore the Rams? Rams are running and hiding, playing as good a football as anybody in the league. San Francisco, Arizona, two teams that are struggling, fighting it out for the basement of the West. And then Monday night, the Patriots go to Buffalo. Patriots just match up. Buffalo just really struggling right now. This is a typical division control game by the Patriots. But Sunday night game, the Saints-Vikings definitely head up the biggest of the matchups. Want to end up with something. I did have one other question that was given to me. It was asking me about, you know, what's my thoughts on luck on the football field and good breaks and good bounces and whatnot. Let me say this. Everything is situational. There are times where, for example, when you got the football and you drop the football after you make a catch and the ball bounces right up into your hands. The ball is oblong in football and it bounces funny. So there's no skill in making the ball bounce right up to you. There's a skill in punting and being able to make the ball stop versus bouncing forward. But in terms of bouncing up into your hands or bouncing up to in another direction, that's pure luck. But let me tell you what's not luck. And I always laugh because even as a kid, I always used to man, those teams are really lucky. And as I got and grew up in the game, in coaching, scouting, I learned that the best teams are the luckiest. You know why? Because there are exceptions, but for the most part, luck is a residue of design and desire. That is what makes up mostly luck. So, for example, you know, if you fumble the football, and I hear this, and there's somebody right there making a play, how lucky are they? No, that's not lucky. There are things you do from a coaching standpoint. Much like in baseball, you don't see it a lot, but if you ever watch a baseball game, the catcher, after a ball is hitting the ground ball, a ground ball is hit, a catcher runs behind the first baseman in case the ball goes through so you can back up the first baseman. Okay, that's design. It's not luck. Okay, it's effort and design to be there. Well, you teach your guys when you're running the football, you got a receiver running, running back running, anybody running. You've got to be in position to block, look for somebody to block, and follow the ball carrier. You follow the ball carrier, you might be able to block somebody and help him go further. And if he fumbles, you're following the ball, so you're in a position to make a play. So when you fumble and there's somebody there, that's not luck. You're in a position, and it's a byproduct of design and desire to get there. I think that's important to understand. And the best teams do the better job of that. The best teams are not just the most talented. You've got the most talented, and you have the best teams. And if you have programs like the Patriots or Alabama, in the case of Alabama, they're the most talented. They're also the best prepared. That's why they're so difficult to beat, and they so rarely lose. Because I can tell you that Ohio State and Clemson are the equal of Alabama in terms of talent. They recruit as many five stars, and they do that as good as Alabama. Every bit as good. They don't win as well because they're not as well coached. Not saying they're not well coached. Landry didn't say that they're not well coached. They're not as well coached as Alabama, and that's why the championships have mounted up. And it's a little thing. Are the Patriots the best team? Well, the Patriots are not always the most talented team. They've got Tom Brady, that gives them a great chance, and they can shift their roster in different directions better than anybody. But they usually are the best teams in most cases because they do the little things well. And yes, they don't make as many mistakes. Well, they're good because, you know, they don't call as many penalties on them. They don't call as many penalties on the better teams because the better teams don't commit as many mistakes. Anyway, so hope that answers that question. Hey, we've had fun today. We appreciate going through a lot of the questions, breaking down the college game, the pro game. And reminder that if you've got any questions, we'll address it here on LandryFootball.com. Just send me a line on the website, and I'll address it for you right here. Remind you to check out LandryFootball.com for all the film room breakdowns, all the college games, all the NFL games, all the latest news and notes from around the college football and NFL world right here on the Landry Football Podcast on LandryFootball.com. Talk to you next time.
To get more of Chris's knowledge, visit and subscribe to LandryFootball.com. You can also find him on Twitter at LandryFootball. This has been Landry Football on Radio Influence.
I'm Jerry Petuck, CEO of Radio Influence. I just wanted to take a quick moment to say thank you for downloading and subscribing to this podcast. There are a lot of people behind the scenes here at Radio Influence that work hard to keep you entertained day in and day out. If you'd like to get involved and advertise on this program, or you have some show ideas that you'd like to see us add to the Radio Influence family, please email us at contact@radioinfluence.com. We all have crazy schedules, so the fact that you took time out of your busy day to let us entertain you for a while means a lot. Without you, the listeners, we wouldn't exist, so thank you again for downloading and subscribing to this show. Don't forget to check out radioinfluence.com to see what other shows we also have to offer. All of Radio Influence's programming can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and of course, radioinfluence.com.